Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
She called it a victory in her book. She told people it has proved its worth.
We should have a good debate that uses accurate information.
Well, the Democratic candidates, particularly when speaking in Ohio, are using NAFTA as a major campaign point. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have generally disavowed the pact. They have each said they would renegotiate NAFTA if elected and pull out entirely if they don't get their way, if the pact does not improve within a six-month window that they can invoke. At the same time, they are in a war of words and flyers with each other over just who is a bigger fan of free trade. To discuss the role of NAFTA and that it's playing in the current campaign, to take a hard look at its lingering effects and to see where do we go from here, are Rick MacArthur, editor and publisher of Harper's Magazine, who also wrote a book about NAFTA, and Alberto Vervulius Bush, editor of El Diario La Prensa, the Spanish language daily here in New York. Rick and Alberto, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And I want to get right to the Democratic talking point from the debate on Tuesday in which NAFTA came up, and talk about these proposals to renegotiate NAFTA or pull out in 6 months that apparently they each committed to. Let's hear another clip of Hillary Clinton.
Let's talk about what we're going to do. It is not enough just to criticize NAFTA, which I have, and for some years now. I have put forth a very specific plan about what I would do. And it does include telling Canada and Mexico that we will opt out unless we renegotiate the core labor and environmental standards, not side agreements, but core agreements, that we will enhance the enforcement mechanism, and that we will have a very clear view of how we're going to review NAFTA going forward to make sure it works.
And from Barack Obama?
I will make sure that we renegotiate in the same way that Senator Clinton talked about. And I think actually Senator Clinton's answer on this one is right. I think we should use the hammer of a potential opt-out as leverage to ensure that we actually get labor and environmental standards that are enforced. And that is not what has been happening so far.
So they agree on this issue. They're threatening or promising to do the same thing. And it's really as close to a clear statement on what each candidate plans as I've heard. Rick MacArthur, put some meat on those bones. When they talk about renegotiating the core labor and environmental standards, not side agreements, but core agreements, and enhancing the enforcement mechanism, what does that mean?
It doesn't mean anything. You're right to call it bones. The side agreements in NAFTA were fig leaves to satisfy labor unions and NAFTA Democrats when Bill Clinton and the Clinton administration was putting all its political muscle behind passing it in 1993 with, by the way, the great help of Newt Gingrich. And when she says we want to put teeth in these things, it's absurd. What they're suggesting is that you would, through a trade agreement, force Mexico, which is what we're talking about, not Canada, it's Mexico that we're concerned with, to raise its labor standards and its environmental standards, raise its wages to the point where you wouldn't have a reason to send the factories to Mexico in the first place. The whole point of NAFTA is to make it safe for American corporations to build factories in Mexico and operate them cheaply without having their assets seized.
Labor or environmental standards could make that meaningful while still being, you know, a free trade agreement?
No, you can't impose. It's like legislating social legislation in Mexico from Washington. You can't do that. The Mexicans, and also it would kill off the whole reason for moving factories to the cheap labor locales where there's no environmental protection agency and a fake labor union. The Mexican labor union is a phony labor union. It's preposterous. Plus, if you look at where the money is coming from to finance Clinton's and Obama's campaigns, it's all pro-free trade people. It's the big investment banks, the big commercial banks, Obama's own book. All you have to do is read The Audacity of Hope to see how much he's bought into the Clinton notion of free trade.
But what about all this union money that goes to the Democratic
Party? There's almost
no
union money. Look, I looked at the statistics the other day. Goldman Sachs by itself, if you look at the combined contributions of Goldman Sachs to Clinton and Obama through January of the campaign, it's about $850,000 to $900,000, I believe, in bundled PAC money. Labor total has donated about $160,000 total.
All right. Let me go to – so obviously, folks, Rick MacArthur is our opponent of the free trade agreements here
today. But also I'm trying to explain what the politics are.
I understand. And Alberto Vervilius Bush, editor of El Diario, who is more supportive, let me turn to you and ask you the same beginning question. When they talk about labor and environmental standards and enforcement mechanisms, are you any more optimistic that they can be meaningful?
Well, I totally agree that their promises to renegotiate NAFTA are meaningless. It's really absurd. It's a complete pander. Not only would it be poorly received both by Canada and Mexico, but also the idea that somehow you can negotiate higher labor wages in Mexico for workers, that's not a negotiable thing. You can't achieve that. And even if you could, what it would do would be to accelerate the loss of jobs to other places like China and India, which have lower labor costs. In fact, the discussion of NAFTA, I'm supportive of NAFTA. I think NAFTA has been good for the United States, good for Mexico, and good for Canada. But there have been winners and losers in NAFTA in all three countries, within all three countries. There have been areas that have won and industries that won and industries that have lost. But the idea behind NAFTA was to have a free trade agreement in which U.S. businesses were able to compete internationally without having to, as a sort of like midway stopping point to full globalized free trade. And NAFTA is not a very large part, is not hugely significant to the U.S. economy. It's become a scapegoat and a whipping boy in a way that is completely out of proportion with its true economic impact.
So what is it that you think is good for the U.S., good for Mexico, good for Canada in the treaty?
Well, I think all three countries have won and lost jobs in different regions. But what it's certainly done is it's allowed U.S. businesses to become more globally competitive at a halfway point. By moving a factory to Mexico, U.S. businesses generally stayed tied into other buy services and goods and capital goods from U.S. companies from the United States, and it stays in the general network of supply, and it helps different industries or in different areas of the United States grow and expand. When factories are moved to China, for example, these supply networks no longer apply, and it's much more likely that new supply networks are built that don't come from the United States. So in a way, NAFTA is a halfway step to full globalized competition.
Before we leave this question of whether labor and environmental standards can actually be enforced, I was in Central America last week in Costa Rica and El Salvador, and I met with somebody whose job it is to help them set up in that region, and of course that's CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, but it's with the United States, the enforcement mechanisms, for example, preparing the courts to receive suits brought by labor unions that would challenge the labor and environmental standards of the companies there under the CAFTA agreement.
Yes, and there are NAFTA courts as well. NAFTA has provisions for precisely that. They're relatively weak and they're difficult and cumbersome to bring through to conclusion because they're often unenforceable. And part of that was from the United States. The United States didn't want enforceable provisions. The United States was worried about being sued, having American companies being sued by other countries. And the United States was unwilling and, you know, not interested, really, in having, you know, any teeth in the enforceability parts of this agreement, just like, you know, you know, so it's not simply a question of Mexico and Canada being leery of American environmental and labor standards. It's a question of the United States did not want to lose control over its own legislation by agreeing to an international treaty which overrides it.
Rick McCarthy, you want to get in?
You're partly right, but you're leaving all the politics out. You're leaving out the reason the Clinton administration did it in the first place, which was so that Bill Clinton could compete with the Republican Party in fundraising. He was able to get the Fortune 500, the Business Roundtable, the big corporations to back him and the Democratic Party in a way they'd never done before because he showed himself to be their friend with NAFTA. It was in large measure a fundraising tactic by Clinton. But you're right that the next big trade agreement they made with China, the permanent normal trade relations with China, has superseded NAFTA as the much bigger, more damaging trade agreement. NAFTA is still doing a lot of damage. There's a plant in Fostoria, Ohio, a spark plug plant owned by Honeywell, which is about to shut down, is in the process of shutting down and moving all its spark plug manufacturing to Mexicali. And I mention it only because it was a central propaganda tool in the NAFTA fight. The chairman of Allied Signal at the time, who was Clinton's great ally in trying to get NAFTA passed, Larry Bossidy, in 1993, held up a spark plug on national TV and said, if we pass NAFTA, we'll have more than 1,100 workers working at our plant in Fostoria making spark plugs. Today, there are about 300 people, and soon there will be none.
So,
but on China, he's right when he says that if we scrap NAFTA, so to speak, or we make it harder for American companies to exploit cheap Mexican labor, the owners of the maquiladoras, the factories along the Mexican border on the Mexican side, some of them will simply shut down, as they've already done, and move their operations to China.
So why, in the current political context, is everybody talking NAFTA, NAFTA, NAFTA? Why aren't they talking the global general agreement on tariffs and trade, or China, China, China in Ohio?
Because look who's financing the two campaigns, Wall Street and the big international law firms who benefit from free trade, so to speak, or cheap labor, or globalization, however you want to describe it. These are the guys who are funding Obama's campaign. He's actually done something brilliant politically. He's poaching on the Clinton's turf. He's made tremendous inroads, fundraising inroads into the top investment banks. And again, all you have to do is read his book to see how buddy-buddy he is with Robert Rubin, the Clinton's great advisor on globalization.
He was the Treasury Secretary.
Who's now a top person at Citigroup, of both campaigns.
Alberto, go ahead.
I don't think it's simply a matter of the funders. I think NAFTA is the only trade agreement that Americans know by name. And it's the only one. It's the focus. It has been the focus of a series of debates, of contentious debates, and Americans, I believe, focus on the relationship between the United States and Mexico to an extent that far exceeds the actual economic importance of NAFTA and the relationship with Mexico. So I think there's a fixation with NAFTA, partly because it stands for all trade agreements, and Americans can't name any other, and also because it also stands for a discussion of U.S. relations with Mexico. And I think that is part of the subtext of this of the debate. And you know, it's very telling that, you know, and these two Democratic candidates can debate in Texas and never mention NAFTA. And the moment there, which is a winner, Texas, regionally, the Texas economy is much stronger and has grown as a result of the agreement and of cross-border trade. Mm. While if as soon as they move to Ohio, then they bring NAFTA to the fore when NAFTA, I mean, whatever consequences NAFTA's had on Ohio, they've been far less than the consequences NAFTA have.
That's not true. If the candidates were being straight, they would also say that NAFTA has contributed to the illegal immigration problem. What's happened, I always explain to people, and it's very important to understand, NAFTA is not a free trade agreement. Ask any economist, a free trade economist, and they'll tell you it's a phony free trade agreement. It's mainly an investment agreement to protect American assets in Mexico, okay? But there is a free trade aspect to it. Tariffs were lowered to zero. They were already very low before NAFTA was passed. As a result, however, Mexican tariffs on corn, which were very high, have gone down to almost nothing. All those little corn farmers in Mexico are being driven off the land. There's no place for them to go but north. They can either work in the maquiladoras for $1 an hour, but if they have any gumption or energy or initiative, after a couple of years they say, this is for the birds, I'm not going to stay here making $1 an hour for the rest of my life, they jump the border because they can make $3 an hour illegally in the United States.
Briefly, Alberto.
So NAFTA has been a tremendous magnet of the rural poor, bringing them up to the border, where many of them are now jumping the border to work illegally in the United States.
Alberto,
there's
do you agree?
The immigration issue is actually a canard. I think, you know, high levels of mobility across the border predated NAFTA.
It's gotten worse. It's gotten worse since NAFTA.
No, what we find are worse. You know, higher levels and a growing percentage actually of immigrants crossing the Mexican border who are not Mexican. So
right.
No, and what we have in NAFTA, and NAFTA isn't strictly speaking a trade agreement; it's a customs house,
yeah.
And it's more modeled in a weird way. It's modeled after closer to the European community, except without the integration
or the labor standards
or the integration aspects.
And Rick, very briefly, what was your second point?
My second point is the exports from the United States. It's exaggerated to say Texas is benefiting because of cross-border trade. The exports under NAFTA are phony exports. The maquiladoras are assembly platforms. The stuff that gets exported, meaning the American-made parts that get sent to the factories in Mexico to be assembled into finished goods, are just shipped right back into the United States. They're not sold in Mexico. They're just made cheaply in Mexico, brought back into the United States to be sold in the United States. So when you look at the export figures on NAFTA, it's a fake number.
But that's not so, I mean, these same products could be assembled and are increasingly assembled in China without drawing any spare parts from the United States. And
China's
therefore
worse.
What you have is the loss of a much larger percentage of jobs, many more jobs, and
true.
You know, products produced at a much lower cost. You know, NAFTA
was the wedge that led the way for permanent normal trading relations with China. Yes, absolutely.
And it's a halfway point between the two. I mean, you know, the plants in Mexico, the maquila plants and the other plants that have grown in Mexico, buy their goods from the United States.
More than a million jobs, according to the Labor Department, have been lost in the United States thanks to NAFTA and these are decent manufacturing jobs. They're not minimum wage jobs.
Right. And Alberto, you're saying no, more because of global trade and patterns.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, if you look at Ohio, just looking at Ohio, 2 to 3 years after NAFTA gets approved and implemented, Ohio has gained jobs, has gained 200 or 300 jobs from before the approval of NAFTA.
What are you talking about? What statistics are you citing? What are you talking about?
This is
total employment.
Yeah, total jobs.
Total employment in the state.
Yeah,
total employment
since 1993 or four when NAFTA was first.
Yeah, I'm telling you that the total employment in manufacturing, in relatively high wage manufacturing jobs, has dropped precipitously.
Right.
A couple of hundred thousand,
after
more than a million for the entire country.
All right,
that's just NAFTA, not China.
Take a deep breath here for a minute.
Okay,
let me reset. My guests on WNYC as we talk about NAFTA as agreed upon by Clinton and Obama in their debate the other night as something that they would renegotiate or get out of in 6 months. My guests are Rick MacArthur, the publisher of Harper's Magazine, who also wrote the book The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy, and Alberto Vervulius Bush, who is more supportive of NAFTA, who's the editor of El Diario La Prensa, the Spanish language daily here in New York. We're going to bring in a minute, a journalist from Costa Rica to talk about how CAFTA relates to all of this. But there was a piece in the New York Sun today with reaction from officials in Canada and Mexico to the debate and saying, let's slow down here. The Mexico ambassador wrote, NAFTA has been a win-win for Mexico, the United States, and Canada, proving that the rising tide can lift all boats. The Canadian finance minister said he was concerned with the rhetoric on the Democratic Party side. So what do they get out of it, Alberto? Why would these governments be so for it? And what kind of diplomatic problems would it present if Clinton or Obama are elected and do invoke this change or trash it policy?
Well, the problems would be great if either Clinton or Obama are serious and try to invoke these. I mean, they would be great in terms of diplomatically the relations with both these countries, and also economically it would be rather disruptive to all three economies. I mean, Mexico has gotten a very large dose of economic stability out of this. The Mexican agriculture and the small farmers in Mexico have clearly lost, as your other guests mentioned, but other sectors of the Mexican economy have gained, and they have gotten to a point. It used to be that in Mexico, at the end of every sexenio, Mexico went through a deep financial and economic crisis, which basically drove the Mexican middle class down back into on the edges of poverty. This has not happened since NAFTA. It's one of those. It's stabilized the Mexican economy dramatically. And
You got a very short memory. There was the peso collapse that took place after NAFTA passed was dramatic. Was dramatic. It impoverished hundreds and thousands of millions of middle-class Mexicans. You can't necessarily blame that on NAFTA, but some people do. So that's another debate. But there was a tremendous disruption in the Mexican economy after NAFTA
passed.
Tremendous peso collapse.
That was before NAFTA.
It occurred after NAFTA passed.
Right after NAFTA passed, yeah. Correct. It was before NAFTA took place.
Before it really took effect, you're saying.
Well,
okay.
But it occurred, I'm saying that the standard of living in Mexico, if you think it's higher for ordinary people or for the lower third or the lower two-fifths of Mexicans, then you haven't been to Mexico recently. I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, for the upper fifth, and maybe for some of the upper middle class, things have improved. But in many ways, NAFTA has also turned Mexico into an American economic colony, whereas it once had its own manufacturing sector. It turned into more and more a cheap labor assembly platform for the United States, which doesn't have its own integrated manufacturing.
Alberto, a short response on this before we turn the page.
Before NAFTA was passed, in Mexico trade with the United States, Mexico, 85% of Mexico's exports to the United States and 80% of Mexico's imports were with the United States before NAFTA. So I don't know. I mean, this is I think that's an exaggeration.
All right. You two aren't the only ones arguing. Here again, Clinton from the Tuesday night debate.
You know, I have been a critic of NAFTA from the very beginning. I didn't have a public position on it because I was part of the administration. But when I started running for the Senate, I have been a critic.
And Obama from a rally in Toledo.
You can't take credit for everything that's good in the Clinton administration and then suddenly say you don't want to take credit for what folks don't like about the Clinton administration.
And we'll bring a Central American voice into this conversation in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Some 150,000 citizens in a country of 4 million people spoke out, expressing their opposition to the agreement. There's strong opposition to a NAFTA-style agreement. In fact, the issue of whether to approve CAFTA has stirred up such political upheaval that the government chose to go to a public referendum instead of to the legislature.
That's the government of Costa Rica that he was talking about there, and he was none other than Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown speaking last October on the Senate floor. I mentioned I was in Costa Rica and El Salvador last week getting an earful from people and an eyeful in the local press about CAFTA. And Costa Rica is an interesting story because, as Sherrod Brown said, the legislature didn't pass it. They put it out to a referendum. It was very contentious. People in Costa Rica told me that they felt that President Arias really pressured the public in ways that maybe distorted the argument to approve the referendum. They did approve the referendum, though. It was pretty close, about 51% to 48%, a highly contentious vote. And in the news just yesterday, Costa Rica was given a 7-month CAFTA deadline extension because the legislature there still has to implement the terms of it. And it's breaking down over things like this: a clause requiring the country's state-run telecommunications industry and its insurance business to open to foreign competition. So they don't like that in the legislature in Costa Rica. And also joining us now is Jillian Gillers. She's a political reporter for the Tico Times, Costa Rica's English language newspaper. Also still with us, Alberto Vervulius Bush, editor of El Diario La Prensa, and Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's. And Jillian, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So it's not a done deal even now, even after that referendum?
No, it's not a done deal, and it's been more than 5 years in the works. They started negotiating this treaty in early 2003, and yesterday all of the parties of CAFTA met in Washington, representatives of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Dominican Republic, and Nicaragua, and the U.S., of course, met to give Costa Rica 7 months more to implement this pact. We are now the only member that's ratified the treaty that hasn't entered it yet.
So why is this so much more contentious in Costa Rica, which is a close ally of the United States in general, than it's been in these other Central American countries plus the Dominican Republic?
Right. And it's surprising because we are a close ally, as you say, especially when you compare us to, you know, other countries that have already entered the pact, like Nicaragua. I think the reason is that the rules in the legislature are such that the minority party, which opposes the treaty, can really put up a fight, can really filibuster these laws, as it did filibuster the treaty for months. And that's why we had to resort to a referendum, a national vote, because lawmakers could not push this treaty through.
What's the biggest objection? Because in the United States, we keep hearing that treaties like CAFTA and NAFTA are going to send American jobs down there. Why do so many people in Costa Rica oppose it?
Well, it's interesting because the debate has centered around non-substantive issues. There are a lot of claims that the gringos, which are is the Spanish word for foreigners, we're going to come take away all our water and wreck the environment. I guess the most convincing reason maybe was that the pinnacles of the welfare state, these sort of social service institutions, which are the telecommunications entity and an insurance monopoly, a state insurance monopoly, would have to be open to competition, and people were worried about that.
Alberto Bush, you familiar with this instance by any chance?
I have not been following the debate in Costa Rica very closely, no.
Rick?
But I think it reflects the debate in other countries as well, you know, where there has been debate, has been concern about losing losing local sovereignty issues to the United States, losing some environmental protections in some cases, and also issues like, for instance, some social welfare questions. Those have been the debates in different countries.
Yeah, the Costa Ricans are concerned about their sovereignty. They're concerned about their domestic economy, whether they're going to be able to control it or not. They don't want to be hauled into the in front of WTO tribunals and accused of violating the sovereign rights of American corporations and so on and so forth. Once you buy into this system of American-style trade agreements, you become hostage to a whole set of things that are beyond your political control. And anybody who believes in self-government or sovereignty or the popular sovereignty, I should say, should be suspicious of trade agreements that have all these conditions in them
and protections
for corporations, for multinational corporations.
Jillian, before you go, a couple of things real quick. We heard in that Senator Sherrod Brown clip the mention of rallies in the streets of Costa Rica. How much of a public issue with rallies in the streets did this become?
There were huge rallies in the streets leading up to the October 7th referendum. The week before, about 100,000 people turned out. Some people wore, you know, grotesque masks of George W. Bush or President Oscar Arias, who is the president of Costa Rica.
And Alberto Bush, I know you have to go, so I want to thank you for joining us. And we'll finish up with Jillian and Rick. Thanks a lot, Alberto.
Thank you, Brian.
Jillian, so they were wearing masks of Bush.
Right.
The other Bush, no relation.
Since the referendum, the movement, the anti-CAFTA movement, has fizzled out a little bit. Most people want to get over with this process, to pass the laws, to enter the treaty, and move on to other things.
And this letter that I read about that President Oscar Arias, and people will remember this is the Nobel Peace Prize winning President Arias, who brokered the whole Central American peace back in the early 90s, now back in office. And he presented a letter a few days before the vote that many thought was meant to intimidate voters. Intimidate how?
Well, the letter was from the Bush administration. It was actually presented the day before the vote, less than 24 hours before the polls opened, and it said that the White House would not renegotiate the treaty if voters decided no on CAFTA the next day, and that unilateral trade benefits under the Caribbean Basin Initiative were uncertain. Some of those benefits are set to expire in September, and people were really, especially, of course, the CAFTA opponents were very upset about that.
It was blackmail. We published that letter in Harper's, actually. It's blackmail.
You published it in Harper's?
Yeah, we published the letter in Harper's, yeah, in the reading section a few months ago.
All right, Jillian Gillers, political reporter for the Tico Times, Costa Rica's English language newspaper. Thanks for joining us from San Jose, the capital of Costa Rica. I had a great time in your country last week, which I'm actually going to talk a little bit more about when we're done with this segment on NAFTA. But thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thank you.
And Rick, before you go, we're talking about Clinton and Obama agreeing on NAFTA in the debate the other day and the need, as they see it, to renegotiate it or get out in 6 months if it's not renegotiated to the satisfaction of the United States. What if John McCain is elected? How different that would that be?
There'll be less posturing. In other words, I'm arguing that Obama and Clinton don't mean a word they're saying, and they won't renegotiate it.
Right.
Or if they renegotiate it, they'll get some kind of symbolic concession from the Mexicans, which is absurd. The Mexicans are on their backs. We're the dominant partner in this. But McCain is a radical free trader, radical pro-liberalization guy who thinks there should be no trade barriers at all, and doesn't give a damn about labor unions, obviously, or he doesn't worry about it at all. So there would be less posturing. You'd have the same policies in effect with less genuflecting to organized labor.
Well,
Democratic
side, it sounds like there will be a robust debate over this once the general election campaign really begins.
I don't think so. I think that it's going to get swept under the rug again. I think that whether it's Obama or Clinton, right now it's come up again because they're fighting for votes in an industrial state that's lost hundreds of thousands of jobs and is continuing to lose lots of jobs because of the trade agreements. But as soon as they get into the national campaign, they're going to think about who's contributing to their campaigns again, and they're going to forget about NAFTA. And that's the cynicism of it. It's a very cynical thing that's going on right now between the two of them. They don't mean what they're saying.
The views of Rick MacArthur, publisher of Harper's and author of The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of American Democracy. Rick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up, a call-in on must-see family travel spots. We went to Costa Rica. Where in the world do you absolutely have to take your kids before they grow up? Or where did your parents take you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Call us now with your must-see family travel spots.